Okay, well, I haven't done one of these for a while. Flying solo, that's right. It is the wishlist edition of hashtag MVSW. Thanks a lot for joining me today. Greg is somewhere. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say where Greg is. He's somewhere, not in New York, but still in America, and won't be back until Tuesday. I know I'm being incredibly vague. Maybe he'll want to talk about it on Tuesday when he returns to the podcast. But in case he doesn't, it is not my place to say. But don't worry, your boy's having a lot of fun. Hey, listen, thanks for joining me today on the podcast. Got a good one planned for you, I hope. I hope you dig it. It's weird when I do podcast solo because my default position is always, you know, let's see how a more historical podcast might sound and might go over. And it kind of splits the audience. So I'm trying to do a little bit of now and a little bit of then. On the podcast today, the now will be Billy Jaffe, who's going to drop by in a couple of moments from Sportsnet and also from Nesson. He'll be aboard to talk about the NHL, sort of do a sort of gloss of where we're at heading into this weekend. Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine will drop by, also writes for NHL.com. You guys all know Kevin. He's like one of our most popular guests. I think on the Reddit, he was listed as one of the most popular guests. So, hey, man, it's always a good time talking to Kevin Woodley. So Kev's back. We'll talk about the evolution of goaltending masks. Why? Well, it's Halloween, dummy, that's why. And if there's one thing, well, the NHL's got, well, hockey really, NHL's got two things, really only one now, because goalie masks aren't what they used to be. But the NHL's got two things that rooks all other sports. One is the jersey. No one does the jersey better than the NHL, better than hockey. It's impossible. It's still the best, hands down. Even if you're a fan of basketball, baseball, football, whatever, take your pick, you got to admit that hockey does it better than anyone else. And the goalie mask is the other one. And speaking of the goalie mask, Doug Favell will drop by. He was a former goaltender in the 70s with the Flyers, the Maple Leafs, and the Colorado Rockies, slipped there. That's where he finished up. We'll talk to him about the first painted mask of all time, which was his, which either he decided to gimmick up as a pumpkin or his trainers in a game before the Los Angeles Kings back in 1970. So we'll get the scoop there from Doug Favell. In the meantime, speaking of netminders, someone that was a netminder for Red Berenson for quite some time as a Wolverine from the University of Michigan is Billy Jaffe. So that's a little shot at Doug McLean there, Billy. How are you today, bud?
Subtle and yet not so subtle. Yeah. When you call it out, I'm well. How are you? I'm practicing my stretching right now, my splits and back.
That's know, right. Get all practice. Your yoga in. Get you know. I hope you programmed yourself to dream last night about stopping pucks, because I know how fickle and weird you goaltenders could be. You know, before we start talking about the NHL right now, Billy, we had Red Berenson, your former coach. No, Billy was not a goaltender, but he did play for the University of Michigan Wolverines under Red. And we had Red on a couple of days ago. When I say the name Red Berenson to you, Billy Jaffe, what comes to mind?
Crushing handshake, yep. Buzz cut, yep. Coffee. Okay.
Coffee?
Coffee. I'm going to guess if he doesn't have a pot, I don't know if it's Folgers or Maxwell House, but trust me, I don't think he's drinking Starbucks or whatever, but if he doesn't have a pot of coffee going regularly, somebody in the office hears it. He's always got his coffee going. And really phenomenal shape for early mid 70s. Phenomenal. But I also think of a guy who respects hockey, respects education, respects the importance of both in, you know, and whether it's hockey or any other sport, you know, he respects the importance of both in people's lives. And, I think of Michigan. I do. I think of the University of Michigan. I know he's been associated with Buffalo and St. Louis, but he's 30 years at Michigan, then coaching alone. And so that to me is the thing that probably jumps out the most.
The first player to ever go from NCAA right into the NHL and turn down the Montreal Canadiens' offer of $16,000 to turn pro because he wanted to finish his education at Michigan. Hey, to the NHL, Billy, when we look around the league right now and, you know, a couple of big games last night, some surprising wins, some maybe surprising losses as well. As you scour the NHL landscape and you look on top where you find Montreal and Anaheim, or on the bottom where you find Carolina, and yikes, in the West, it's Arizona. The Coyotes are just bottoming out. They can't buy goals or shots on goal, for that matter. What's been the biggest surprise for you so far this year?
You know, nothing. I'll start with the West because you pointed out Arizona. Nothing really at the bottom surprises me. Colorado is kind of languishing their way through. I didn't think they'd be awful. I didn't think they'd be great, though. I thought they'd be okay. They'd battle for playoffs. In a good way, Calgary has surprised me. I especially given the injuries they have, and again, they're just a 500 team basically right now. But Bob Hartley seems to have a really good way about him now, and he's found a way for a quote-unquote older coach. And he's not by no means old. We know that. But you know, he's not one of the new era coaches. He's found a way, but whether it's Marty Gelina or whatever, to get through to young guys. He's found that, and that's an important skill. And so I think that he's done a nice job. Yep. Go ahead.
I was going to say, let's pause on Hartley for a second. We roundtabled this yesterday on the Thursday night national broadcast, me and Shanny and Doug McLean. There's a new wave of coaching flavor in the NHL right now, which is an almost sort of NHL celebrity makeover of guys that coached before, where once upon a time it was the rush to get, you know, cheap American Hockey League coaches into the NHL. Yeah. Now it seems as if, and Daryl Sutter is probably the touchstone for all of it, coaches that have reinvented themselves, who have had success in the past. I would put Hartley in that mix. Certainly Sutter's at the vanguard there. Ken Hitchcock. You'd have to consider Michel Therrien in Montreal. Is that just the flavor of the month? And, hey, whatever success. And we made the point yesterday. Like, even Doug himself admitted, he said, hey, listen, if it weren't for the success of Daryl Sutter, I probably wouldn't have had an interview for the Pittsburgh job. Is this the flavor of the month, a trend? How do you see this movement to bring aboard coaches that have had success in the past but have had to redo themselves?
Well, I think we're seeing I'll comment on that in 1 second, but I do think we're seeing an era more, Jeff, of education, and not analytics so much, but the ability to think differently. I think that has become even more so. And I think of Willie Desjardins, I think of Mike Johnson in Pittsburgh. I think we're at a dual kind of, like, let's give these guys a chance type mode, but the dual being, let's give new guys a chance, but new guys that have really proven themselves almost in an academic surrounding. John Cooper comes to mind too. Again, albeit he's younger than Johnson and Desjardins. And then let's also give some other guys that are proven an opportunity. But if you're not willing to change, those guys that you mentioned would have been fired by now. Bob Hartley, if he didn't show early on in his days, first with Calgary, with Jay Feaster, and then early with Brian Burke, that he was willing, he was willing to think new age just enough, that he was willing to incorporate styles that are different, players that are different, use assistant coaches perhaps a little differently. They wouldn't be able to survive. And I think that's a big deal. Like, you know, Daryl Sutter, he's cutting edge in some ways. I mean, the way he coaches, I mean, forget the press conferences and forget all that's his personality. But in other ways, you know, I mean, putting, you know, some teams, and maybe it's also just a result of great management, but, you know, you're putting Mike Richards on that fourth line, but the way that he gets through to those players, Mike Richards is okay with it. I'm sure at times he wishes, you know, he was second line or whatever, but how do you argue the success of what Daryl's done there? If you can manage players and you can incorporate new style play, your success, whether you're old or new, and that's what we're seeing with these guys.
You know, and with Daryl too, one of the things that I like about watching Kings hockey, it seems as if Billy Hill, at every single moment when someone has the puck, they put it in a place that creates a battle, that creates a fight. I mean, this is right out of the pages of Viking Alberta and the old farm, but it seems as if the puck goes into a place where they create a fight, and knowing that they are, you know, top three heaviest teams in the NHL, 9 times out of 10, they're going to come away with the puck.
Right. Well, it's the ultimate play to your strengths. You know, if you're going to run, sprint. You know, if you're a sprinter, I mean, you're going to run. Don't try for a marathon. You know, don't do that. And Anaheim or LA, I mean, is a team that allows for itself to win battles, not just because of their size, but also because of their support, their puck support too. They do that really well. They have enough skill once they get the puck into certain areas that they can finish or will finish it, and especially skill from a guy like Doughty from the backside. But on the other hand, their strength is their size, and it's their strength in numbers. And by putting it into areas, as you point out, and by supporting each other, they're usually able to dominate the puck in the offensive zone.
You know, back to Hartley and the Calgary Flames, Billy, for a second here. When you look at the squad, if you want to look at it maybe sort of cynically, I know a lot of people said, you know, this is a really hard-working team, and they earn every inch of ice, and they claw and scratch for every single point. How much do we look at the Calgary Flames now, eighth in the Western Conference, 12 points after 11 games, and say, you know what? It's a team that's not loaded with talent, but they have four guys on defense in Brody and Giordano and Weidman and Russell, alongside a goaltender that'll always keep them in games. Your thoughts?
You know, they may have more talent than we realize. The Monahans, despite his okay start statistically, the Backlunds, they're not loaded chock full of it. But Joel Colburn, I mean, here is a guy that is talented and you know, didn't always have it pulled out of him, but Bob Hartley has again found a way to kind of manage or massage it more out of him. Now, granted, we have players that are hurt there. I'm just using names in general. Yes, it doesn't have the most talent. There's no doubt about it. But it's a pretty obvious comment, though, that I'll say the goaltending can save them literally an awful lot, and they're getting that. And, boy, I'll tell you what, has there been a player in the NHL, and I'm talking through hardcore hockey fans in the hockey world, that having more of a coming-out party, so to speak, attention-wise, especially in Canada, than TJ Brody? I mean, of course, the new contract helps. But the amount of talk about him and, oh, my God, what he's doing in the 25 minutes a night and the ability to get in offensively and to outlet the puck, pass the puck and everything, that's been very noticeable this year, and he's gotten a lot of credit for it. So, sure, it helps a lot. But I just think that there is also a team-first attitude in Calgary. I don't know how far that will take them when it's all said and done. I think they're gonna be like this all year, Jeff, at their best. You know what I mean? They're going to battle all year. But at least there feels like there's hope in Calgary. There's a belief system there.
You know, we're doing the Vancouver game last night, and I'm reading Bruce Dobigan's book right now about the rise and fall of that maybe the greatest Vancouver Canucks team of all time, one that unfortunately for them didn't win the Stanley Cup, losing, of course, to the Boston Bruins in seven games on home ice. And we saw the unraveling of Vancouver specifically last season where the wheels came off. Are we starting to see the same thing happen in the Eastern Conference with a team that beat them for the Stanley Cup in 2011 in the Boston Bruins?
Wheels coming off. I'm not ready to say that, no. Not at the, you know, they played their 12th game and they went 6-6. That's the thing that, you know, they're a 500 team with a plethora, a preponderance, a gaggle, whatever fancy word I can use for this smart show of yours.
Yes.
It's been a, you know, they've had injuries and situations and everything. And to go through the list, I'm sure you've done it ad nauseum on your show, but the whole, you know, Smith and Krug in camp for the first 8 days, you've heard all of it, right? The defenseman hurt, Campbell hurt, the trade of Boychuk, blah, 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 all that stuff. This is not what you would call a stable start to the season. With that said, have they been at times lacking in defensive awareness and smarts? Absolutely. Absolutely. Have they been subpar in coverage? Absolutely. Have they struggled at times to score? Yep. But am I ready to say the wheels are coming off? No. Now, if you're calling wheels coming off a middle of the pack team but making the playoffs, well, that might be this year just because of their situation, and they're trying to incorporate the old, you know, big bad Boston Bruins, which are really not that big and bad anymore, meaning their average height and weight now. Yes, Chara and Lucic and Soderberg are big in McQuaid, but besides that, Jeff, they're middle of the pack. But they're trying to incorporate the new era in. They're trying to get, you know, more fourth line speed. They're trying to get quicker throughout their lineup, and they're dealing with a different D crew. So may they be a number four or five seed in the East? I still think they could end up being at the top, but could they be middle of the pack? Sure. Mm-hmm. But I've seen with L.A. the last few years, it doesn't matter where you start, it's where you finish once the playoffs begin.
Billy, something you and I have talked about a couple of different times with the Boston Bruins, and that is the style of play, specifically in their own zone. It's difficult. It's challenging. They play the same way in Providence, the American League team as well with Bruce Cassidy. They just don't chase. How hard is that in the NHL? How difficult is that to play?
You know, a better person to ask will be one of their defensemen, because and I'll still give you my answer on it, because the hard part, every one of them will tell you, is when they come from their different pro team into the Bruins system, they say it's hard to adjust. But once they adjust, they're fine, and it says it's almost easier. Not almost, it's easier to play. That's the thing. Once you adjust to it, the D-men basically don't chase pass for argument's sake. If you're on the right side and you're coming up the half wall, you'll take your man past a little past the hash mark, but then you'll fade. You'll kind of turn back, pivot back towards the middle, and you'll protect the middle. Is it a box in one kind of, you know, that type of thing? It puts the onus on the read of the defenseman, the forward support as well, the middle of the ice. The back door is always covered by the weak side D in theory. Again, they've had a lot of miscues early on in this season, Jeff. But the thing is, when you're used to moving an awful lot of the defenseman and chasing and either playing a man-on-man or a zone where you're allowed to go up and then you switch and if somebody come down for you, that's the big difference. You've got to understand when there's a time you got to release from the chase, so to speak, from the movement. And that's the hard thing. But again, every guy I ask that finally comes in, when they say, when I figure it out, it's easier. One of the other adjustments, Jeff, for this team, by the way, is for the Boston Bruins, is how when they break out, they don't come over, meaning they don't usually send the weak side guy in the breakout. A lot of teams will slash him over to support the play, high slot, neutral zone, et cetera. The Bruins go wide. They utilize a D-to-D wide play more often than not, and therefore that's harder for a lot of the wingers that are used to cheating over, fading over to support the play. Louis Erickson told me, we talked a lot about it last year, it took him a while to get used to staying wide the whole time. That's a different mentality, too.
Hey, Billy, before we wrap up, a couple of minutes, Kevin Woodley's going to drop by from In Goal Magazine. Doug Favell's going to be aboard here in about 15 or 16 minutes' time as well, former Flyer Maple Leaf and Rocky. We're talking a lot about goalie masks. Yep. It is a Halloween, after all, so it kind of seems a natural. And it's, you know what, I'm a lazy guy at the end of the day, and it's a nice, lazy topic for me to do on
it's
a Friday.
Perfect.
I know, it's kind of ideal. Hey, what was your favorite goalie mask growing up? I mean, you and I are from the same vintage, so we grew up in the great golden era of goalie masks. Which was your favorite?
Well, I love that, was it the Gilles Graton? Did I say that
the tiger
right?
Mask. The tiger, yeah.
Jerry Cheever's to me was fantastic, too, the stitching. And I was a Bruin fan growing up, you know, admittedly. But the one that always stood out to me a lot because I saw it an awful lot. Well, the other one was, I couldn't remember, it was Gary Smith with the, he had the tiger on his mask too. There was a skull mask and then he had a tiger mask as well.
Oh, Gary Bromley.
Okay, Bromley. Okay. But Murray Bannerman's mask. Bannerman's mask. I mean, well, being growing up in Chicago, and he just had the Blackhawk. It had a different shape to it, a little harder. Yep. I can't really describe it here. You know, it had a little different shape, and then it kind of looked like an Indian headdress a little, and then it looked it was just distinct. It was just distinct. So it was neat. And seeing it a lot, I always liked it. But I love what the goalies do on their mask nowadays. I do. I love the creativity. But I'll tell you what, there's nothing like the Favels, the Wayne Thomases, the Liutes, all the Bannermans, et cetera, the Cheevers, because they had the full mask to paint on with no eye. And the things that they came up with were so unique. And also, here's the thing. They're not as intricate. A lot of these masks nowadays have five different things on them, and you're trying to figure them out, and I can't see them. They all mean something to the goaltender, and that's great, but I can't see them. The old masks, so you could see them. Like, forgive me for not remembering the names, but there were guys with the who was the goalie with the California Golden Seals that had the snake on his mask too?
Gary Simmons.
Gary Simmons, thank you. So I got my Smiths and everything. Gary Simmons. I mean, that was spectacular. Yeah. And you know what? You better believe I'm pulling up when I'm done talking to you. You know, I mean, Joe's Malosh with the Cleveland Barons. I mean, those were spectacular masks right there. So anyway, those are just great. I mean, you look at those things now, and again, I will go and look at them, and some of those were really creepy. Cool and creepy. So that was, you know, that's fun.
It's funny too, because yeah, you think of like the Bromley mask and the Simmons mask as well, you know, with the skull or with the cobra or something like that. But in a lot of ways, you know, something as simple as what Jim Rutherford used to wear, or even, you know, Pelly Lindbergh, you know, the ghost mask, the plain white mask was, I mean, and then of course, you know, the tribute in Friday the 13th, you know, became the sort of penultimate, but those masks were creepy. Like, just something about the mask in general in the NHL at that time was creepy, regardless of whether it was painted or not.
Well, because it was, you know, was it Jimmy Rutherford that, who was it him or was it Ron Lowe that had the white mask with the little wings right around his eye?
That was Jim Rutherford. That was Rutherford.
Okay, so just the littlest thing on these white masks that all had their own unique shape, because remember, and I know you know this, but the fans up there might not remember, they used to take goalies, put them in a dental chair basically, lay them back, and cover their face with the plaster mold, and they put tubes through their noses or straws through their noses to breathe out of.
They could breathe, yeah.
In some ways, these looked like their faces or a real face significantly more than what we see out of these masks nowadays, which are incredibly, again, beautiful in color and style, but they're amazingly protective, and that's the most important thing. But those older masks look like a mask, and therefore they, or a face, I mean, and therefore they had this eeriness about them that were spectacular.
Yeah, they were. Hey, Billy, thanks as always for stopping by. We'll let you go and get on with your afternoon. Thanks so much for stopping by, bud. We'll see you around the shop soon.
You got it. I'm going to go plaster my face right now and wear that out tonight. You got it.
It is Friday. We know we like to get plastered. Enjoy that, Billy.
Hey, good tying. Yes.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. I know. And they say this country has no poets, Billy. They say this country has no poets. Thanks, bud. We'll talk soon.
See you later.
There he is, Billy Jaffe from Sportsnet and also from Nesson. And we'll pick up that goaltending mask conversation with one of our favorites. Now, when we talk goalie, anything goaltending, our go-to, our default position is always our man Kevin Woodley from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. Kevin, how are you today, sir?
I'm good, but how do I follow that? That was excellent. Like, Billy's got all the great vintage masks. He nailed them all. Like, I literally this Sunday, Jeff, I have a piece on NHL.com. It's like over 3,000 words on the history of goalie masks. Like, from how Cheevers inspired a generation and the best of each generation and the best of each genre. And he nailed all the top ones. It was great. It was great.
You see, here's the thing for me. I mean, goalie masks, I mean, in the 70s, that was it, man. Those goalie masks were fantastic. And I've always looked at goalie masks then versus now and equated it to albums versus CDs. And when, you know, CD became the format of choice for music, sure, the music itself improved, but we lost the artwork. We lost album cover artwork. And as goaltending masks became safer and became, you know, for goaltenders as the shots became harder and higher, we lost the art of the goalie mask. Where once upon a time, you know, and we'll have Doug Favell on here in a couple of seconds, you could paint up the whole mask and you could see it and you had a full canvas to work on. Now there's only select areas on the mask that you can work with. So to me, the goalie mask of the 70s was the LP, and the goalie masks that we see now are the CD of its generation. Agree or disagree?
It's a good analogy, but, you know, as a goaltender and talking to some of the guys who wore those old fiberglass snug-fitting masks, they paid a high price for your art.
Oh, yeah.
John Garrett telling me about, you know, every time he got hit in the face with a shot, the torque of that mask being so snug against his face, which it just broke his nose once, and then every time it would re-break.
Yeah.
So, or just the pressure cuts, you know, like, you know, 20, 30 stitches deep. And so we needed it. It may have made it tougher on the painters to, it just doesn't have the same feel as it did back then. And so Ron Hextall made a good point when I talked to him about it, and he's kept all his masks and collected a few others over the years. And, you know, it wasn't just the paint jobs over the whole face, like Graton, and, you know, you mentioned Simmons, and Bromley's one of my favorites with the original, you know, on Halloween, the original skull mask.
Yeah.
you know, it wasn't just that, but it was the shape of the masks. And as Ron told me, you know, he felt like there was personality coming to the masks even before Cheevers put those black marks on and started sort of the modern paint job. You know, it wasn't technically paint, but that was the one that kind of started it all. And it was in the shape of those masks. And you look back and, you know, they cut out the eye holes in different patterns. Some of them could look, you know, a little more sinister than others just based on the way they cut out holes in certain places or the way they shaped it, you know, how far down the chin. And, you know, there was some character already coming in the way they shaped the masks, and paint just added to it. Now, listen, it may not be the same now that we've got that big hole in the middle. But don't diminish the artwork being done on them. There is some incredible stuff by some incredibly talented airbrushers that's going on right now. And hey, the one good thing about having our, you know, the cage covering the face is we got that whole animal swallowing human thing going on, and some of the great books like Brian Hayward with the San Jose Sharks mask with a great white swallowing him in the middle of it in the early 90s. So we've had some beauties in the new genre too.
That was a great one. You know, Favell's coming up here in a couple of moments, and his mask was, I want to say it was an Ernie Higgins, I think. Did you have a favorite style from that era?
From a mask painting standpoint?
Mask painting, mask design.
You know what? Looking back for this project, I kind of liked it, you know, when they started to, you know, some of the logos, was Rutherford with the sort of, the Red Wings logo kind of coming out over the eyes. That was kind of one of the original ones. And I liked it when they got into the full, you know, I like Gritons and I like Bromleys, and I like the ones where they got into the full, you know, kind of transform the goaltender into something else on that face, whether it was an animal or a skull or, you know, that type of thing. I mean, and it was kind of haunting the way they looked. The eyes kind of looked out from behind that mask. It was, like you said, it was artwork and, like kind of, you know, modern art piece living all at once. It's like that creepy painting on the wall in the horror movies where the eyes start moving behind it. You kind of have that in real life in the NHL.
It's so interesting. I'm not sure when the last time you were at the Hall of Fame, but whenever I go in there, the only time that I feel like I'm in an art gallery is when I go to the section with the goalie masks. That's when I feel like, you know, I'm at the Louvre or something. I'm actually in the presence of art. And I know full well that, you know, the jerseys are one thing and the various designs of the equipment, but that's when I really feel like I'm in the presence of art.
Well, and it's the last bastion of expressionism for professional athletes. I mean, where else do, and who else, what other position gets to show off a personal touch? I mean, especially in hockey, and, you know, whether it's uniforms or, you know, quotes after the game. It's a conformity type league, and, you know, goalie masks are that one last place where, you know, you can do something cool with it, whether it's just to show off the team, as Hextall said, he likes those best, or to show off a little personal flair, or develop your own brand. I mean, Cujo and Ed Belfour. I mean, Ed Belfour was Ed Belfour before Harrison painted an eagle on there, and he became Eddie the Eagle. So, yeah, it kind of, you know, whether it's an individual brand or doing the team, you know, promoting the team, it really is kind of that last bastion of, you know, unique expressionism in I would argue, pretty much all of pro sports.
Only got a couple of minutes left with you, Kevin. I want to get to goaltending right now. And you're always, you know, you always have your thumb on the pulse of what goaltenders are doing and how they're playing and what the new styles are and the innovations. Are you seeing anything different out of goaltenders this year? And the VH, I think the last time we spoke, or one of the last times we spoke, was kind of a thing. Are we still there, or have we moved on to something else?
Well, we definitely moved on to the reverse VH, which is the opposite of VH, and that's been an evolution over the past couple of years. And frankly, in Sweden, where they were way ahead of us on it, it's been 5-6 years. So you had guys like Victor Fast come over, and it was just being sort of learned by everyone at the pro level here, and he'd already been doing it for years. So that's where we're at. It's not certainly new. Most goalies have added it in the past couple of seasons, and yet there are still some that are trying to integrate it. And what we're seeing now is, you know, different evolutions of it where it's one thing to go into that position on the post where, and the reverse is kind of, they call it the reverse because it's the opposite of the VH. That lead pad goes down along the ice against the post, either with your toe on the post or with the, you know, the shin of your pad just inside the post. And you lean that lead arm up to seal the post. And then your back leg is off the ice. Yeah, about 30 degrees is the optimal angle from goalie coaches I talk to. And that back edge is kind of driving your body into the post to kind of form that seal. And goalies like it because their hands are still more free compared to the VH, which is a very rigid locking, blocking type of save and creates a lot of rebounds and bad scrambles. They feel like they can have more active hands. They feel like they can take passes away through the blue ice. Goalie coaches like it because it puts more of the goalie's torso in the net rather than on the post like the VH did. There's a lot of benefits to it. Where we're seeing the evolution now is guys being able to get in and out of it more fluidly and how they use that back, that drive edge I talked about, the one that's off the ice, to actually change their angle and swivel around the post and then drive rotation out of it and build momentum out of it so you're not stuck on your post. You get stuck there, and that's when you're getting exploited with passes up high and into the middle. And you've got to be mobile out of it. And almost every goalie, I would say, now has reverse in their game in terms of being able to get to that position or using it at some point, and in some cases overusing it, and shooters are figuring it out. But not everyone has gotten to the point where they get in and out of it effectively and powerfully, and that's kind of where the next step of the evolution is. To me, if you're using it too early, you're getting stuck in it. Shooters are already going to school on it. I talked to a few that, you know, went to goalie camps in the summer and saw goalies doing it and figured out how they could exploit it. And you know, if you're getting stuck in it too early, you will get picked apart. You've got to be able to move in and out of it more effectively than some guys are right now.
Awesome. Thanks. Kevin, we got to wrap on that. Thanks, as always, for stopping by. I look forward to the piece on NHL.com on, is it the history of the mask or the evolution of the mask?
Kind of the history and the evolution. I mean, it goes everywhere. And there probably isn't going to be enough 70s stuff to keep you happy, Jeff. We get into the modern stuff maybe a little too quickly after talking to you. But, you know, just how Cheever's kind of inspired and where it went from there. And we walk through all the genres, whether it's the scary masks or the animal heads or the, you know, the tributes. There's been some great ones over the years. And you know, there's going to be something for everyone in there. And it sounds to me like the guys at NHL.com really put some work in dressing it up and showing off, like you said, the art form that is the mask both back then and nowadays.
That's awesome. Look forward to it Sunday on NHL.com. Thanks, Kevin. We'll check in soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Take care.
There is Kevin Woodley. Check him out at NHL.com. The big piece coming out on Sunday on the evolution of the goalie mask. Also, he is, of course, our friend from In Goal magazine. We stick with the goaltending theme, and we talked about goaltending masks, and this next gentleman certainly has a well-told story, and one on Halloween we always like to tell, and we figured why not get it first person this time around. Also, was at the vanguard of another movement. As much as people will point at Tony Esposito for being one of, if not the first, to use the butterfly style, Doug Favell was right there as well, using that same style in the 70s with the Flyers, the Maple Leafs, and the Colorado Rockies. Doug Favell joins me now. Doug, how are you today, sir?
Good, Jeff. Nice to talk to you.
The pleasure is all mine. Just so we can hear it first person, because I always love telling the story, and I always want to make sure that I get the details right. Jerry Cheevers was the first putting the stitches on the mask. You were the first to have a full mask painted. It was Halloween. It was 1970. You were playing with the Philadelphia Flyers. It was after a morning skate. You were playing the Los Angeles Kings that evening. Did you ask the trainers to paint your mask, or did they do it as a goof to make your head look like a pumpkin that night, Doug?
Yeah, I think my head looked like a pumpkin anyway, so I think it was a natural fit to do it. But no, it just came as a, you know, the bantering in the morning of the game in Halloween was coincidental, and we were all kidding around in the room, and somebody had said, you know, anybody going to the party now, you're going to dress up, and somebody was kidding me, you know, like as always happens in the dressing room. They said, Fabby, why don't you show up tonight as a goaltender? You know, dress up as a goaltender tonight. Okay, maybe I'll do that. So the kidding started, and as we were getting ready to leave, I said to Frank Lewis, who was our trainer, I said, Frank, you know what? Maybe we should, you know, tonight Halloween, the orange sweaters and everything. And we always wore white at home then. I said, why don't we put orange on that? Can you paint orange on the mask? We'll paint it like the Great Pumpkin, because back then Charlie Brown and the Great Pumpkin were a big thing. And I said, why don't we paint it like a pumpkin tonight? And just for Halloween, he said, yeah, I can do that. So he took it home in the afternoon and painted it orange. And I came back that night and we wore it. And I wore it. And the funny thing is, you know what? We're all so superstitious that if we hadn't won that night, we beat LA 4-1. If we hadn't won that night, I'd have probably just painted it white again And if we'd have lost and said, you know, that's it, it's no good. But we won, and and we kept going, and we actually got on a little streak, I think. And I said, you know, this is a pretty good thing. So anyway, it was that simple.
Did you find, Doug, that when you went to the Orange Mask, you found shooters, I don't know, let's just say floating shots a little bit higher to try to hit the pumpkin?
No, I don't think so. But what happened was I actually talked to some people that we started talking about it, and the guys were saying, geez, you know, it's a bit of a distraction because it was fairly bright. And I talked to it in the summer. I talked to an eye doctor and ophthalmologist, and he said, you know, it's really interesting because he said, your eye will attract. So I thought it was an advantage because guys were coming down and, you know, you only have a few seconds to look, and your eye would naturally go to the brightest thing. So in that flash, they actually would flash on my mask with their eyes instead of looking at the net. So it was kind of a distraction. I thought it was, I needed whatever I could get to distract the shooters. So I went with it. And then the next year, we painted the starburst on it, which was the design, which was actually done because it was even more of a distraction for the shooters. So anyway, that's the story, huh?
It's, you know, it's a wonderful story, and always one we like to recount around this time. The other question I've always wanted to ask you, Doug, what was up with the curved blocker? You were the first guy that I ever saw curve his blocker. Why'd you do that?
Well, I didn't do it on purpose. I think I got hit a lot in the glove, and it just naturally curved. But I used to cut out the I always wanted my hand free. I didn't like the confines of the glove itself. It was very restrictive when you held it, and it had padding in the fingers, and I didn't like the padding in the fingers. And I used to play lacrosse. I always took all the padding out of my gloves, and we cut the palms out when you played lacrosse. And I liked the feel of having it right on the stick. So I did that with my glove. I cut all the padding out of the fingers in the glove. And I also extended there was a little piece of leather that held it to the side. And I put, instead of having a little piece of leather there, I put a little spandex attachment to it. So I had a lot of movement with the glove in that sense. So that was probably one of the reasons. And I did do a lot of, I liked the feel of it without the bottom of the blocker on it. So we bent it. We tried to bend it a little bit upwards. Mm-hmm. So that I'd have freedom in my hands, because I always wanted to be the guy that scored the goal, but I never got the chance. I always thought I could shoot it from one end to the other. So
you wanted to be the original Hextall, is that essentially
I wanted
what you were
to
going
be the
for,
original. Yeah, I wanted to score a goal. I actually hit the goal post one night in the minors in Oklahoma City. Yeah, before I think it was Michelle Plass scored one down there.
Playing with Kansas
League.
City, I think.
Jerry Cheevers and I played in the Central League together in Oklahoma City in 65 and 66. And I had a chance one night, but I hit the side of the goalpost. So that was the closest.
I bet the crowd was going berserk. You know, something I want to ask you about as well. I have a very rare video, and whenever any hockey people come over to my house, I always sort of break it out because – it's not really in existence. I think there's only a handful of people that have this. It's from Game 3 of the 1965 Memorial Cup. It's Niagara Falls and the Edmonton Oil Kings. You were on that team, and this is the Sanderson-Falkenberg incident. It's one of the most violent games that I've ever seen. You were on that team. You won the Memorial Cup, Game 3. I remember it got so violent, Doug, and I always try to impress on people like the level of violence back then. It got so violent that, as you well know, in Canada, the only way to get people to stop doing something and get them to stand still, you played God Save the Queen. And as this brawl is going on, very faintly in the back of the old Edmonton Gardens, you can hear them playing God Save the Queen. Now, you guys didn't stop, mind you. The Sanderson-Falkenberg is what it is, and it's quite violent. But what was your takeaway from that game, and where were you when all this was going on?
Well, I actually started the game, but I got thrown out in the first period. For fighting.
I think Ricky Lee got thrown out early too, didn't he?
Yeah. There's two of us, Ricky Lee and myself. We got thrown out, and I was actually, and we had jackets and ties on, and then, but they told me because of the atmosphere in the arena, because of the fight, I'd been in a fight with a fellow named Bill Bennett, and those days I didn't realize, but they because I came out of the net and we had kind of a semi brawl, and I was in a fight with Bill Bennett. They threw me out of the game. Well, you know, they weren't very smart because once I left, Bernie was coming in. So
yep.
That wasn't a good move. And then they tried getting me out.
That's for our listeners, that's Bernie Parent that Doug is referring to as well. So here comes the Hall of Famer.
Yeah. So, no, it was violent. I actually have the scrapbook. I kept the scrapbook of stuff, and I have the pictures, and they had German Shepherd. The police called in the dogs.
Yeah.
And there were dogs on the ice. They had police dogs on the ice trying to break up all the fights. And I remember John Arbor took a stick to a policeman come up because he was hammering some Edmonton guy. And the policeman come up behind him and hit him over the head with a billy club.
Yeah.
Well, he got up, and this is a different era. I mean, this is 60 years or 50 years ago, right?
Yep.
He turned around and grabbed his stick and started clubbing the cop on the ice.
John Arbor did?
The cop was defenseless because he's got leather shoes on the ice.
Yeah.
And, I mean, John just took the stick and whacked him across the, you know, across the top of the shoulders a couple of times. And then all hell broke loose, and the dogs came in, and I got a picture right in my scrapbook of all the dogs, you know, running around on the ice.
It was crazy.
It was wild.
It's one of the first videos I've ever seen where the policeman hit the ice. I remember talking to Bob McGill once, and his dad was at the game, and I showed Bob the video. He said, "You know what? My dad always told me about this game, but I never believed him. I never believed a game could be that violent, but it was."
Oh, it was. It all started, actually, just if you've got time, I'll tell you. It all started because we come in after the first period, and Bill Goldsworthy
had
been speared by Bob Falkenberg, and he'd speared him through the side. And back then, the equipment was quite different, right? You weren't that protected. And he had a big, like a cut, almost a cut right halfway around the side of him where Falkenberg had speared him. So Hap M's come in and said, you know, you guys better get even. Better get that guy. They're not going to run us out of this ring, you know, like they did 2 years ago. So we went now, and Sanderson went up to Falkenberg when another fight broke out. And Sanderson went up to Falkenberg and told him to drop his gloves. And Bob Falkenberg wouldn't drop his gloves or his stick.
Yep.
So Sanderson circled around, and eventually he did sucker him, which wasn't good. But Falkenberg wouldn't drop his gloves or his stick. So Sanderson just whacked him, and then that's when the bench is all emptied and everybody.
And then the cops hit the ice, and Sanderson, I mean, I've watched the video countless times. I mean, he gets him about four or five, maybe six or seven other times when Falkenberg's already out and he's on the ice. It's a rough one to watch, and you were there.
Yeah,
though.
No, hey, it wasn't. It's not good. You know, it's not. I don't condone it. It wasn't good, but you know what? When you're in the situation, you do what you have to do, and you think you're defending yourself, and it was a bad situation. It shouldn't have happened, but unfortunately, that was hockey.
Let's end on an interesting note here as well, historical notes. Doug, you're one of my favorite goaltenders to watch when I was younger. Your athletic style, that butterfly style, was just so much fun in an era where goaltenders were, and you know, Bernie was this way, very economical and angular and got to play the angles and all that. You were a fun goaltender to watch. I had Red Berenson on the program. You know where I'm going with this. I had Red Berenson on the show a couple of days ago, head coach, University of Michigan. I don't think this time we talked about the six goals in the St. Louis-Philadelphia game. But you were the goaltender that night for the Philadelphia Flyers. What are your recollections of Red Berenson turning into Maurice Richard?
Well, I've tried to get it out of my mind, but I do remember it was November 7th, 1968. So I think it's etched in there for a while.
Yeah.
It was one of those nights, and I mean, Red probably tell you the story. It was incredible because he scored six goals, and I think he hit the goalpost twice.
Wow.
And I stopped him on a breakaway on another one. And that it was just one of those nights. He had everything going. I mean, I didn't play that great, but I didn't play that, you know, that bad.
Yeah.
And he got six goals out of the seven. So there we were at 7-0. But the funny story was we went back in after, believe it or not, I think the next game I played was in St. Louis. And we went, and I was starting, and we went out. And of course, they had a big night for Red.
Yep.
They gave him a new car.
Wow.
They gave him a canoe because he was an outdoorsman and everything.
Still is, yeah, still is.
And we were standing there, and they gave him all this stuff. And after that, everybody was kind of skating around and doing stuff. I kind of went up beside Rhett, and I said, Rhett, at least you could have given me the canoe.
You helped them out after all. Get into the record books for kind of loud, Doug.
And the other thing we didn't realize back then, because we didn't have video back then. Not a lot of video. Like, we didn't watch video. We didn't do anything. But so they replayed all the goals. You know, we all had to stand out there and watch this. And they replayed all the goals on the big screen. And so we're standing there watching all this. And Dan Kelly was doing the play-by-play. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we realized that every place is Berenson's got the puck. He's around Van Imp. He goes in, he scores. Next goal was Berenson's got the puck. He breaks up the middle. He blows by Van Imp. He's in, he scores. The next goal was the same thing. It was all six goals. He went by Eddie Van Imp. And we didn't know. Like, we didn't think about it at the time.
And you're the only guy that takes...
Joe Watson came in after the first period, and he said, Jesus, Eddie. He says, I can't believe it. He said, you and I were in for all those goals.
Yeah, but the goaltender is the one that's going to take the heat for it. Where are the horns?
They say score six against Pavel, but they don't mention Van Imp and Watson.
Van Imp and Watson on the ice. You just think of, Van Imp, the guy that took down Harlamov in that game against the Red Army. Oh, yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
Doug, it's always a pleasure catching up. Always have a good time talking to you. You have delightful stories, not just this time of year, but any time of year as well. Look forward to catching up with you down the road.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it very much.
There he is, Doug Pavel.
Happy Halloween.
To you as well, sir, and your mask very much the inspiration for Halloween around the NHL, the pumpkin mask of Doug Favell. Have a look at it. Go to your Google Images and have a peek at the original fully painted mask, Doug Favell, 1970, in a game against the Los Angeles Kings. That started it all, folks. I know Cheevers was the first to put the Knicks on there and stuff, but the first fully painted mask was our man, Doug Favell. The pumpkin mask. Yeah. Pretty cool. So we finished the week talking about pumpkin masks, and Red Berenson started the week talking with Red Berenson, and then I had Billy Jaffe on today, who was coached by Red Berenson. So it's been a big Wolverine week here on the MVSW podcast. All right, listen, I got to hustle. Thanks so much for dropping by. And again, it is Halloween, as Doug just mentioned as we signed off. So if you're driving tonight, maybe go a little bit slower. No, not maybe. Do go a little bit slower. Be a little extra careful out there. A lot of kids around, including mine. Okay, if you're listening and you live in Stouffville, we're going out trick-or-treating around 5:30, maybe 5:30. So drive a little bit slower, maybe stay off the road altogether. Maybe don't order a pizza or Chinese food around that time so there's not too many delivery guys and gals out on the road. That would be nice, too. Thanks for joining us this week. Podcast is kind of up in the air for next week. I will let you know on the Twitters what the plan is for Monday, but we will be back for sure on Tuesday, me and the Wish. In the meantime, Sunday, I can't plug this enough. It's just going to be a lot of fun. We're doing something called The Big Ice, and by we, I mean myself, Elliot Friedman, Ken Reed, our buddy Steve Dangle, Brian Hayes from TSN Radio, Jeremy Taggart, drummer formerly from OLP, our strength and conditioning coach, Matt Brown, who's playing the keyboards behind me here. Listen to Matty right here. Yeah, sounded good, Matt. Laurie Dupuis is going to be by as well, Olympic gold medalist from 1998. It is essentially TED Talks, but for hockey. They'll be in around the NHL panel. For those that are local, Taggart, Hayes, and Dangle will be doing a Maple Leafs hot stove. Doors open at 5. All the yakking begins around 6. And then when we're done, we're sipping and talking with you guys. Should be a lot of fun. It is in Toronto. It is Sunday, November the 2nd, at a place called The Garrison, which is a really cool music club as well. 1197 Dundas West, on thebigice.com for more information. Again, doors open at 5, and the show begins at 6. So you can check out me, Frege, Reader, Tag, Hayes, Dangle, and our man Matt Brown hosting the entire event. He will be the, as we like to say, Massacre of Ceremonies. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Hope to see you on Sunday if you're in the area. Would love to have a conversation with you before, after, during. I mean, it's all open forum. You know, floor is yours. Ask away. So that's Sunday at the Garrison, 1197 Dundas West. It is The Big Ice, Better Hockey Conversations. And thanks for being part of our conversation this week. Check me out on Twitter at Jeff Merrick, of course, at Wyshynski for Greg. Have a nice, safe, fun weekend. And we'll talk at you early next week. Oh, wait. We missed Game Show Friday. Oh, that sucks. Oh, well. Talk to you next week.